the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
You're very welcome back. It's now time for the Culture Club, and I'm delighted to say that our guest this week is none other than the singer, songwriter, and global superstar, David Gray. You're very welcome to the Culture Club.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've a lot to get through, but I suppose the reason you're here is, I suppose, you've got your tour, your past and present tour, coming to Dublin, Cork and Belfast this summer. And this is off the back, I suppose, of your album last year, Dear Life. But it's past and present, I suppose, is the tone and tenor of the tour. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. It was... Sometimes when I write a new record, I feel that it's going to have trouble competing with the big songs in the set. So I have to think carefully about how I'm going to present the new music. It's important for most tours to represent the present as well as the past. Mm. But with this record, I felt it could go shoulder to shoulder with some of those big songs. I feel that the Dear Life, the music on Dear Life is very melodic. It's very direct. And that's been borne out by the tour. And I also wanted to do like a deep dive each night. So not just the big hits, which are always there, and some of the new music, but also to focus on different albums like Lost Songs, New Day at Midnight, things that haven't been played so much, A Century Ends or whatever, and do a little deep dive each night into, so shake it up essentially. So with rehearsals, we looked at over 70 songs. And we've played about that many across the tour. So we've really varied the set list. So although the big numbers are always in, and some of the key songs from the new record, the rest of the set's quite fluid and sort of changes. So it keeps it fresh for us, importantly, but also for the audience. And that it's had a kind of celebrational energy. I've managed to remain present on stage rather than just switch into sort of industrial
autopilot.
Industrial music making mode, which when you're doing sort of tens and tens and tens of shows, can be sort of a trap you fall into when you start to think that every gig's the same. So I've made it deliberately different, and it's worked. Keeping everybody, including the audience, slightly off balance so that it enables something to happen particular to that night is important.
Yeah.
So that's been my approach, and it's been a phenomenal tour. I mean, phenomenal tour. So that's why we've rolled on into this summer, because there was demand, and not just for tickets, but from us to do more shows, because it's just with big audiences like at the Electric Picnic or Radio 2 last summer, but also in, you know, theatres, traditional theatres or the Albert Hall. The show's just really, really worked. And these things don't go on forever. I've got my band around me. They're the flesh of my music. How long can I rely on them? We're all getting a little bit older and more fragile and more mental. So it's like capitalize on having this incredible resource. And let's just all enjoy making the most of it. So that's sort of what the tour is about. It's something for us and something for the crowd.
And what's the pressure then in terms of, maybe do you front load the new songs at the front of the show, or do you kind of mix and match it, or do you kind of have to dangle sort of a hit to kind of get everybody going?
Well, I think first of all, it's very important to have confidence that the new songs are going to carry across.
Sure.
So that you don't have to just making time till you drop Sail Away into the set or something. So I don't do that. I work in slowly until the sort of bigger songs start to come into the package. So it's different every night, as I just said. So I don't usually start with a couple of oldies, drop a new one in, or front load the front of the set with the new stuff. I've done that in the past as a it seemed like the best approach. Let's do some new stuff, then get stuff, because it's hard to activate the crowd into sort of full sing-along mode and then get them back to listening to something they don't know so well. So, I mean, when you've had some success and you've got songs that do sort of get the crowd going, gigs are a sort of dealing with that. And it's a negotiation how you play the audience and their attention and how you bring their emotions into the package. So, yeah, that's just guided. But I mean, but luckily, I think I've got songs, even though they might not be hits. So things like the title track of Life in Slow Motion, for example. Big song, and when people hear it through the speakers and it's thundering down on them, they're captivated by that. They're held in the spell, and then you follow that up with the one I love, and then they sort of release a bit of energy, and then you bring them back into blah blah blah. So it's a kind of flow. It's a sort of confluence of different things all flowing into each other and through each other, and inevitably landing in somewhere like Sail Away at the end of the set or something.
I watched back in advance of this, I watched back your interview on Tommy Tiernan, and you played, I think, after the harvest.
I did, yeah.
And it was a beautiful acoustic version of that song, which is quite different to the album version.
Yeah.
Is there a temptation when you go live that you might not go with the band version that's the one on the album, or is it, do you kind of feel, nah, like that's the version that probably people want to hear?
Interesting. Yes, I kind of contemplated doing acoustic versions of some of the songs. I haven't activated that yet as part of this tour. Mm. It'll definitely happen in the future. Well, there was one gig when we were playing in Denver, the weather was very bad coming over from Salt Lake City, and the band and the crew couldn't get there with the gear. We packed up some guitars and I flew over with a skeleton crew. We rode across in an aeroplane and landed in Denver, and we put a show on, which was just me. We hired a piano. Mm. So I did do all the songs acoustically. So there was one gig on the tour. And it was great, actually, for songs like Eyes Made Rain and After the Harvest, which really will stand up perfectly well on their own two feet with just a guitar.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like I can represent everything on this record with just a guitar or a piano. I can't always say that. Sometimes technology has played such a part that I'm not quite sure how I'm going to flesh the music out on my own. So, but with this record, I feel like I can. So in the future, as these songs come into the set list, it may well be that they come on into the set in a different form. I break it down. I think that if a song has really got what it takes, then when you bring it back to its bare essentials, it should almost be more than when you put the band behind it in some senses, or capable of having the same kind of impact, but in a different way.
One of the things that's remarkable about artists like yourself is how good your voice has remained. I mean, I don't think you've dropped any keys in terms of the songs. I mean, I was just listening to some of your more recent performances. I mean, this voice is still there. What do you do to keep it in good nick?
Yeah, I don't have a management program except just use it regularly because it's a muscle. So before a tour starts now, the adrenaline is already starting to simmer, knowing that I've got gigs in a couple of months. Mm. And I know that a few weeks out from rehearsals, I'll start practicing. And by that, I mean, I'll do an hour straight or something of just one song after another, partly to get my concentration on, to remember all the songs and the intricacies of the songs, but also just to get my voice fit so that when I go into rehearsals, I'm just not on the back foot and it just knocks 10 tons of crap out of me, because singing all day long with the band is very, very tiring. I mean, a gig is a couple of hours. It's a different intensity when you're on the stage. Yeah. The difference between a training session and a match. It's the real thing. You're not going to hold back. You're going to go. But I've also learned to manage just where I put the notes and how hard I hit them a little better. And I don't drink and smoke like I used to when I was a younger man.
Yeah.
I'm more careful with that as well. So it's a general sort of energy management program. Obviously, looking after my voice is the main preoccupation on the tour. Full stop.
Yeah.
And it's paranoia, you know, but it's like because it's a beam of energy and you're basically very energy short. You're just being shot around from one place to another and losing sleep here, there and everywhere. Yeah. And you've got to do another gig. So that's the challenge. And the most human part of the whole mechanism is this bit of singing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've found that my voice is getting stronger and, you know, touch wood. It's
not sure what type of wood this is, but
I don't think that is wood. I think it's MDF, but there isn't any wood. The studios of the future don't have wood in them. That's all gone. It will continue to look after me into the next decade. Because I do have to hit those notes, and they're very high. Alibi, songs like this. I'm even as high as a high A at times.
Yeah.
That's high. You know, high B, if I'm feeling particularly fruity. I did hit a few high Bs on this tour.
Very good. Listen, let's get into your choices. Now, for your first single, or for your favourite single, you've selected I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats.
It's my first single. The first single I bought, I could have chosen like Puff the Magic Dragon or something like that, which I bought at sort of 8 years old when I was learning how to roll a joint. No, I'm only joking. This is the first single I bought when I sort of went to secondary school, and I saw it on Top of the Pops and went out and saved up my dinner money or pocket money, whatever. Mm. And I went into town and I bought it.
Do you remember how much it cost you?
No, but it would have been pence.
Pence.
40p or something, 50p. Yes. Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, a bag of crisps was about 3p at that point. So let's just scale down the single. It was probably about 25p or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I can't remember, but I had a sort of green and black kind of paper thing. And then it wasn't like a hard sleeve. It was a very, they were very cheap things.
Yeah, yeah.
You're cheap, so you could listen to the song. So Yeah, this is the song. It's quite a theatrical song, but I was, you know, young. I was 11. I'd just gone to secondary school. So this was the first one I bought, and I loved this track.
So let's take a listen. This is I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats. We could listen to all of that, but we probably would have time. Well,
that was a trip down memory lane. Good, yeah. I haven't listened to that in a long time now.
And would you have been like out on your own buying that at the time, or was that a very popular choice, say, amongst your contemporaries?
I can't remember. I was out on my own. I didn't have older brothers and sisters. Lived in a tiny little fishing village where we didn't really have proper radio reception. It was right, okay. Nestled down. And the rabbits and rodents would gnaw through the TV cables which were, I think, so we'd have like the most crackly kind of crap sort of view of, so we were lucky to get Top of the Pops beamed in faintly on a Thursday night. Yeah. So you kind of, it was like a word of mouth thing, and then you go to the school disco and you'd hear things and you'd rush off and buy them. But that's so I would have been out of my own. I would have just liked that, the theatricality of this particular song. And then gone to buy it, and then found someone else in the playground who also liked it, and blah blah blah.
Your album choice is one that when I did the Culture Club, I think was on my short list of, and it's Van Morrison's Astral Weeks. Now for me, this was a iconic album. This was a real transformative album for me. Why have you chosen Astral Weeks?
I think I had to, because it's the record I've probably gone back to the most. And there's so many albums I could have put there, I suppose. But yeah, this one just kind of renews itself because there's a kind of unresolvedness to it. And like all the greatest things, that's because it was an act of creative bravery and chance taking, and nobody was in control. There was no one at the helm. It might sound like Van is, where this was a sort of musical event where jazzers kind of came in with Van. He was obviously like a force. But what you had was this strange fusion of ideas and the kind of unkemptness. It's like tangled undergrowth. The music is just going all over the place. Will the bass player ever hit the root note?
Yes.
That's the big question as you go through tracks 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And I love it. Van was on a kind of Wordsworthian sort of quest, and he brought this kind of Celtic mysticism in to an emotionally hungry, sort of devouring kind of, he's like a super eye scanning the world and ideas. It's a strange, intense record, almost hallucinogenic. You don't really know where he's taking you. And then suddenly he seems to be going back into a sort of Yeatsian sort of Irish idyll, and then he's somewhere else. He's in a kind of frozen present of sort of cold realities. And
I mean, you move from, say, like Cypress Avenue or Madame George into The Way Young Lovers Do. I mean, a kind of, it's a roller coaster look.
It's amazing. And I think it is a moment of chance, a chance coming together that no one was in control of. No one can fully take ownership of. And anyway, it wasn't the first album of his that I grew to love. I came to Van a bit later than I came to a lot of the other sort of heavyweight singer-songwriters at that time. But when I heard this one, after I'd heard St. Dominic's Preview and Moondance, which were a bit more obvious in a way, I was sort of befuddled by my first listen. But from the second listen, I began to be being drawn in, and I'm still drawn in now. I yearn to be able to make something equally sort of wild and carefree that has such a strong sense of spirit and yearning that you just, that's what you fasten onto, the core of the music. I heard that when he recorded it, I don't know if it's true or not, that he didn't have the band in his cans. He just had himself because it's chaos, basically. So,
is that your ideal?
he's like a lighthouse beam in the middle of this kind of, as I say, this kind of undergrowth, this sort of entangledness of sound that's just making itself around him in that freedom that they had in the late 60s and the 70s to experiment and be free. But he's got such a sense of purpose. That's what drives the record home, is this power, this sort of Wordsworthian drive that he's driving through images, and just one thing, so the light is on the left side of your head, it just says everything, and like you just get these images. So it's like a kaleidoscopic sort of, I don't know, array of ideas that doesn't really resolve in any way. So that's what makes it fascinating. And the songs I was less keen on when I started listening, I now love the most, like Slim Slow Slider and things. So it keeps the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, I don't think I could give a better introduction to Astro Weeks than that given by David Gray. So let's take a listen to Astro Weeks.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the dead center back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, lay down, the silence easy to be born again, to be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. Now, we have a lot to get through. So, but Bill Callahan and Smog were your choice of band and artist. Why?
Because that's, I'm just going to go more into the last 20 years of my listening life. And he's the artist I've listened to the most. If you looked at my Spotify numbers, he's way out in front of anybody else by a million miles.
And what is it particularly that...
Because I think it's very hard to find new space to do something new with songwriting, and he managed to do it. In a kind of post-punk kind of raw way at times, but his use of ideas and his lateral thinking, his sense of humour, the sort of deadpan humour, the gentleness with which he prizes open a concept. He's master lyricist and master ideas man. And like some artists like him and Nick Cave, I sort of imagine they write the lyric out, then they try and put words to music.
Where for often people it's the other way around.
But rather than being driven by a melody, so he's not the most melodic writer, but he just wants to find space for the idea to hit. So he'll stop the chord at a certain, or change key, whatever feels. It's kind of randomness to the thing, which I think shows a words first, music second process. Anyway, that's just my take on it. But like, yes, I've been to his gigs whenever he's played in London over the last 15 years. I've been there. It's always different and sometimes perplexingly so, but it's never dull. And he's brought a smile to my face, a musical smile and a lyrical smile to my face more than anyone else.
Brilliant. Well, let's take a listen. We have Smog with Cold-Blooded Old Times.
She said we didn't see a thing. We said we didn't see a thing. And father left at 8. Nearly splintering the gate. Cold-blooded old times. Cold-blooded old times. Cold-blooded old times. Cold-blooded old times. The type of memories that turn your bones to glass. Turn your bones to glass. And though you were just a little squirrel, you understood every word. And in this way, they gave you clarity, a cold-blooded clarity, cold-blooded old time.
That's another we could listen to all day. That's fabulous. Moving swiftly along now, we're going back to the 1980s, 1986, for your gig, and you've picked The Cure and their Glastonbury set.
Yeah, I'm a massive Cure fan, so my sort of musical journey began with, after I'd got the Boonton Rats out of my system, began with The Specials and Madness and sort of Two Tone, the unexpected blossoming of ska, sort of high energy punky ska in the late 70s. That was the first thing I was hooked on. But as that began to wane in the ever-changing music scene, the sort of indie scene of The Smiths, The Cure, The Cult, Cocteau Twins, that was the kind of thing. And there's something about Robert Smith that just absolutely, he just got his hooks in me. Mm. It's not just the sort of his take on things, it's his musicality, it's the way he, which has influenced me definitely, the way he picks a note, plays a solo.
And yeah. Do you think The Cure hold up as much as anybody else? Because some people would say they were brilliant that back in the day, but maybe they have dated somewhat.
I don't know. It's not like I listen to all the current records enough to be able to give you an opinion on that. I think that the thing was, I don't think so. I think Robert Smith is just as burningly sincere now as he was then. Mm. And I think his strengths are just as strong. It's just whether your journey with the band sometimes ends at a certain point. And for me, it ended shortly after this. This was the point of my life. My Cure high point was the Head on the Door sort of era when they kind of got really poppy. And when they then became even bigger after that with like Disintegration and things, I'd sort of stopped listening and I was listening to other things then. Yeah. But that record, when I heard In Between Days for the first time, I was like, what? I mean, it was so poppy. It was I'd say it was a bit like As It Was by Harry Styles, in that the immediacy of the riffs were just so massive. You couldn't help but like it. So dumb and simple in a way, but it was total pop music, but with him at the center of it, making it a kind of compelling, weird mix. So his tension in there makes it something else. So anyway, this gig, I was at Glastonbury for the first time. We blagged in. There wasn't even a security fence in 1986. So we didn't even know we were in the festival. We thought we were still on the outskirts in some sort of hinterland of Glastonbury until we saw someone. It was the Psychedelic Furs came onto the main stage. It was like, we're here.
Yeah.
This is it. This is Glastonbury. Well, we're in. And then anyway, the next night, it was The Cure headlining Saturday night. Yeah. And I sang every word. It was an amazing gig. We had a thunderstorm. The moon came up. The sun was going down and a thunderstorm. And I'll leave you with one image from that day. The dry ice, which they were pumping out prodigiously onto the stage. As the thunderstorm started, the wind started raking left to right across the stage. And they had these dry ice shadows. So Robert and the boys, they were like, they had a dry ice shadow of themselves to the left of them. So it was just incredible with the lights coming through and the starting to get dark. And they broke into something like a forest or 100 years from pornography. I think that was what happened.
Well, we have close to me.
Mind
from that.
Blown.
Well, we have close to me from that particular set. So let's take a listen. That was The Cure and Close to Me from their 1986 Glastonbury set. David, we're moving on to your choice of movie, and you've gone for Little Dieter Needs to Fly by Werner Herzog.
Yeah, well, you know, my mind went blank when asked this question. I'm not, first of all, I've got to confess that I'm not a real big movie guy. I love films, right? Mm. But I think because I was brought up in the middle of nowhere, there's one cinema. It was about a 45-minute bus ride away, and the bus is stopped at night, so you wouldn't be able to get back. So it wasn't like something I could go to
easily.
So, and you know, like there were lots of movies in those days shown on Channel 4, but we had Espedwarec, we had the Welsh version, see, and the movies weren't as gripping. The Welsh movies weren't as gripping as the ones they were blowing people's minds with in the UK.
You weren't fed a diet of Richard Burton, though.
So I haven't really built this movie going, I will forget to go to the cinema year in, year out. I just don't think to do it. It's not that I don't want to go and see a film. I love seeing a good film. So, I didn't obviously go to see this at the cinema, although I would love to. Werner Herzog, I sort of plugged into him, I guess, about 20, 25 years ago, and began to sort of go through his movies. And then someone suggested watching this one, which is the incredible story of a young man who, while British bombers are blowing his village apart in the Second World War, Dieter, instead of hiding in the basement, crawls up to his bedroom and stares out the window. And as he does so, the bomber is coming down the main street kind of thing. And he makes eye contact with the pilot who's dropping the bombs. Mm. And some strange magic happens and he becomes fixated on being a pilot. And he's this sort of... he's got to be there. So it's Germany after the war. The war ends. He's living in a world of ruins. He has shattered education and prospects, but he sort of sets his mind to becoming a pilot. Decides to do that. He's going to have to get to America. So that's the first epic part of his story. He gets to America. And when he gets to America, he realizes it's not so easy to be a pilot. You actually need a degree. So then he has to learn English and then take a degree. So he goes through this ridiculous process. Eventually he becomes a pilot. So that part is quite incredible in itself. But then the war breaks out in Vietnam. He's on the first combat mission behind enemy lines and he gets shot down. So his very first flight as a pilot in the war, he's shot down and he's captured and then he's imprisoned. And he's in the prisoner of war camp, which is obviously grim, and eventually manages to escape with another person. And it tells the story of the whole thing. He's rescued, but by this point, he's just a human skeleton sort of in the woods and being stalked by a bear, which is waiting for him to die, which is just like his shadow. And Werner Herzog is a very instinctive filmmaker. He doesn't care for all the fripperies and the fanciness and the framing. He's all about something happening in the moment. So radically, he takes Dieter, who is obviously still suffering from PTSD from his experiences, back to the prisoner of war camp, back to Vietnam. And he actually carries him through on this weird pole, like back through the jungle to reenact his capture, which is utterly outrageous. These days he would be probably locked up for doing that, but this was probably back in the 80s. Anyway, it's an incredible story of human survival, and Herzog is the only person who could ever have made the film. And so I don't know another film like it. I love his stuff. I could have picked Grizzly Man or, you know, some of his other movies, which are also fascinating. But there's something about this one that really... It's master storytelling, and Dieter himself is a very compelling character, but it makes you just realize how strange and compelling and impossible life is, and that this man shaped this extraordinary life. So Werner, when you meet him at the beginning, Dieter's hoarding enormous amounts of food in his house. So you start in the present before he takes him back to Vietnam. He's got, like, under his floorboards, vast amounts of food in case anything ever happens and he'll be all right, sort of things.
Well, I mean, that's gripping in itself in terms of the description. We're going to move on to your theatre pick, which is Prokofiev's Cinderella, which is part of a production by the Royal Ballet. This is an unusual choice, no?
Yeah, you asked me what theatre thing, and I went to this last year.
Yeah.
And darling, I loved every moment of it. the first album, you know, I'm coming right back at Timothy Chalamet with his sort of ballet put down. Mm. Before there was cinema, before there was all of this stuff, the magic was on the stage and remains there. Mm. And this was a potent reminder of how magical music and staging can be. because they did the original staging. Prokofiev's music, for a start, I absolutely love. And this was one of the first albums I ever had. Had Romeo and Juliet on one side and Prokofiev's Cinderella on the other. Not in their entirety, but like a highlights package.
Yeah.
So I know the music well. So there's a point at the end, the last movement of the whole thing, where the entire stage was dark and all the fairies and the fairy godmother are right at the back of the stage on what is like an island in a lake. But they literally dim all the lights. You can't see what's there. And one by one, their wands fade up, these tiny dots of blue light. And then there's the fairy godmother in the middle with this incredible swooning. The love theme of the whole thing begins to play. Oh, my God, I'm getting emotional now just thinking about it.
Mm.
It was pure magic. It was absolutely pure magic. And slowly, just from the light of the wands, you start to be able to make them out at the back. And then, of course, they begin to put a little on their little toes. They just tremble out onto the stage and very slowly a dim light starts to emerge. It's just the
power of it.
The magic of the music added to this incredible. And it completely beguiled me. I was absolutely blown away. Absolutely blown. So I've seen all kinds of wonderful things in the theatre over the years. I love going to the theatre. But this was a recent memory, and when I sort of delved, this one just popped up. So I don't spend a lot of time going to watch ballet or opera or anything like that. But when I do, it's never disappointing. It's incredibly high quality. It's ludicrous.
Your book pick is an interesting one, and it's one I have been bewitched by for quite a while. Is The Living Mountain by Nan Shepherd?
Yeah. I love reading, and that's something reading is my go-to, I suppose. Mm. And yeah, this book it remained in a drawer. She wrote it and based on conversations with her publisher and artistic friends and writers at the time, decided not to put it out. It was written sort of at the end of the Second World War. They wanted something more upbeat and, but it's her relationship to the Cairngorm mountain range.
In Scotland.
And it's a very personal, sensual account of her deep relation to the land and attenuation to all its facets. Everything from the moving of water, the singing of water, the freezing of water, the shape of rock, the darkness, the feel of heather under bare feet. She embraces the entire thing and sees the entire range as being one giant mountain. Mm. And it's a love song, but it's more than that. It's actually why it rings so powerfully is it's what we all need to do, which is reattenuate to the land that and the air that we breathe and the land that holds us up and the water that sustains us. She's entirely in step with this landscape, and it's the most compelling. She doesn't poeticize. She's spare in her language and her emotional giving. She doesn't overwhelm you with her emotional response. It's a more carefully and long. It's taken over time. It's not a snapshot with emotions poured on top. It's a slowly wrought over experiential layers. She's sort of made these very spare. It's like Muir. It's as intense as John Muir, the famous Scottish naturalist who moved to America and founded the first national park in Yosemite. So it has this. I wouldn't say religiosity. I say sensuality, but this care for all things and seeing the sort of the bigger picture. So. Yes, it's a very short book. You can probably read it in, you know, an afternoon. But
and we have a clip narrated by Tilda Swanton, so let's take a quick listen.
Oh, Tilda.
At first, mad to recover the tang of height, I made always for the summits and would not take time to explore the recesses. But late one September, I went on Brerioch with a man who knew the hill better than I did then, and he took me aside into Corra and Lochan. One could not have asked a fitter day for the first vision of this rare loch. The equinoctial storms had been severe. Snow, that hardly ever fails to powder the plateau about the third week of September, had fallen close and thick. But now the storms had passed. The air was keen and buoyant, with a brilliancy as of ice. The waters of the loch were frost-cold to the fingers. And how still! How incredibly withdrawn and tranquil. Climb as often as you will, Loch Corra and Lochan remains incredible. It cannot be seen until one stands almost on its lip, but only height hides it.
It's Quite moving there, isn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, Tilda's amazing as well. So hats off to Tilda. What a great choice. I haven't ever heard that before. Wonderful. Withdrawn. What a wonderful word there. Mm.
Oh. Your TV pick, which is an interesting one, is Match of the Day.
Well, it's I have a love-hate relationship with it, depending how my team is doing.
Now, which side of Manchester now are you, blue or red?
The only side that matters.
So blue. Blue.
Very funny.
Sorry, I'm blue, so.
I'm a red.
You're a red, okay.
Yeah, I haven't been taken to United since I was a little boy. So my granddad was a season ticket holder. My dad was used to go every week. He was there, watched the Busby Babes, the last match. Mm. So there was this kind of emotional, that changed his life, I think. A lot happened in my dad's life around that time that was tragic, but... Mm. He never got over what happened. To be watching this team, idolizing this team, this young, amazing team, and then suddenly they just weren't there anymore.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's part of the backstory, obviously, of being a United fan. But it was definitely part of my dad's emotional reality that was transferred somehow to me. So I used to be taken, and this was in the dark years of the 1970s. I've seen them being beaten by just about everyone. Leeds United, Nottingham Forest, Liverpool. You know, I think we even lost to Birmingham City one time. I went. So when we moved to Wales, I'd go Easter and New Year, Christmas, New Year. We'd come up to Manchester, stay with folks, and I'd be taken to whatever games. And if the United progressed in the cups, my granddad would give us the season ticket to go to the cup game. So I saw semi-finals and finals through the 70s and 80s.
Wow, okay.
So I was at the Arsenal final, for example, the 3-2. I was at the 1-0 Norman Whiteside against Everton. I saw us lose to Liverpool in the League Cup. Whiteside scored in that as well. So I've been to a lot of games over the years. Yeah, but I'm not a very easy watcher these days. And I'm also sort of hair shirt wearing, old time bore that can't stand the sort of gladiatorial nonsense that's been sort of foisted on us by Sky TV and all the sort of media cohort that want to make so much of all the blather and crap that goes along with these people rolling around on the ground. And
should Michael Carrick be given the job full time, or is it too early to say?
I don't think you can say. Let's just see how the season. There seems to be something in the water at United. I think the problems run much deeper than the manager.
Mm.
I personally like to see Ratliff out. And, and maybe the whole sort of corporate sort of group, really. I don't feel love there. I just see some kind of something else, some kind of weird steely glint that's based on money and nothing else.
Okay.
So I think the problems lie much deeper than the manager. I think it's kind of cosmetic surgery. And I think this is a distraction, you know. I don't know. I think what we've seen a lot is managers starting to look promising. Ten Hag, blah, 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 Solskjaer, blah, blah. And then it kind of peters out. So let's just hope that Carrick managed to resuscitate after the 19-week layoff they've just had in mid-season, which I thought was a little over the top.
26 days or something.
I think if he can resuscitate the vibe and the momentum and we would finish the season well, they'd have a hard job not to give it to him, because who are you going to give it to anyway? But... yeah, I don't really know. I think that the problems run a lot deeper, and I think the passion that's there, the story that's there, needs to be honest. I mean, the reason I've singled him out to say he should go is when he besmirched the club with his racist bigotry a few weeks ago, it went beyond anything I've ever seen at United. How can you say such a thing? You can't associate with a club and come out with these statements. If you want to be a reform voter, go and be one.
Yeah.
But you have to do it in private, because now you're part of Manchester United. It's like, do you not understand the thing, man? Who do you think you are? Just because you've made billions out of petrochemicals or whatever. So that upset me enormously. And I didn't really know what to do with myself.
Okay.
I posted a Kick It Out logo with a MUFC and a heart and said, football stands together, on my Instagram. But my initial response was more like the one I've just given, which was, I was horrified.
Yeah.
I was absolutely horrified. So it's a strange time. I think you've got the World Cup being milked for everything that it's worth. It's like, is this football or is it just nonsense? I'm not quite sure where the line starts. One's line starts and the other one stops.
It does, yeah. And I would share a lot of your views in relation to that. And, you know, I suppose when you see what Infantino has done with Trump and the the peace award and all the kind of stuff, it's...
When you think you're ready for the next wave of nonsense to hit you, they make an even bigger one, and it's sort of it's impossible to keep up at the moment.
We have to finish with your buried treasure. Now, what have you picked?
Well, I could have gone with like music songs. So we could, I can see you've got a picture of a leaf there. So I'm going to solo out my a recent exhibition that, very thankfully, my friends Alistair and Emma told me to go. It was at the Garden Museum in Lambeth Palace, down opposite the Palace of Westminster. A small exhibition of the paintings of Rory McEwen, someone who I've never heard of, but Rory McEwen, very interesting character. He had the first music sort of show. So in the documentary they were showing in the exhibition, Van Morrison's on there saying that he was one of the reasons he kind of believed he could become a musician. Mm. So he was playing like skiffle and blues and folk and things like that and world music. So it was a hullabaloo, it was called. It was one of the first sort of BBC programmes. Now, Rory McEwen sounds like a kind of fierce Glaswegian, but he was actually a sort of Eton educated sort of aristocrat, essentially. Who was, yes, a folk singer and used to sing with his brother and various people, and he made various records. He was big part of the folk scene, the kind of Ewan McColl era sort of British folk scene. Mm. But also from a very early age, he painted botanical pictures. But I wouldn't always be that interested in botanical art, but there's something that goes on, particularly with his later pictures of leaves, solitary leaves, that's just extraordinary, transcendent. What you see is transcendent attention, because anyone who's ever picked a leaf off the street and taken it home will notice how quickly it dries up and turns to dust. So you've got, in real time, hours, maybe less, to make your painting. And these things were done with watercolour on vellum. Now, vellum is calfskin. And that, when I read that before I went in, I thought, that's a bit of an affectation. Who paints on vellum? But actually, when you see the works, paper absorbs colour and pigment. Where vellum sort of upholds it in a completely different way. There's a luminosity. So that these are exquisite things. And I use the word in its true sense. And there's a sense of mortality that's born on these solitary leaves that he's picked off the street. And he died a tragic death. He got very, very ill. And it's hard not to read a little bit of that end story into the final pictures. But they are truly extraordinary things. They could be put on display in any museum in the world, next to the Mona Lisa or Titian, whatever you want, and Rembrandt, and they'll stand up next to them. This is high art. They're amazing things.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Well, that's a wonderful way to finish. I want to thank David Gray for being our guest here on the Culture Club this week. You are playing Cork Live at the Marquee on June 13th and 14th, Belfast SSE Arena on June 16th, and Dublin's Fairview Park on June 17th. We're going to play you out, David, with one of your own songs, plus and minus.
Go on.
Thank you very much.
All the way desire is always wanting something that it just can't have. Turning love's picture to the wall. Next moment there's no turning back. The following report may contain scenes that some might find upsetting. Look at me, read what's written here. This whole routine is getting old.
It's getting old.
You know the way the light is always painting someone else's windows go. Fate sends a bottle spinning round. I steal a glance that stops you cold. Remind me why we're doing this. You know it's silly, but I keep forgetting. Darling, from where I'm sitting, hey, this whole routine is getting old. It's getting old. So for the fire that gets lit, ooh, and for the flame that regrets it,
as you are the plus and minus.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.